Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield.
Okay,
excuse
Charlotte.
Me, George.
Yeah, Charlotte, how are you doing? Okay, everything all right?
Everything's fine, George. I hope things are well with you.
Okay, well, we lost a really important person this week on Wednesday, the 2nd of August. And he was Jim Mars, and we had several interviews with him. And what were some of your impressions about Jim Mars, Charlotte?
He was an excellent journalist, an excellent writer. He also has a distinguished, remarkable career path that made him, you know, I don't know that he could call himself a subject matter expert, but he certainly brought a lot of things to light that other people, he made connections that other people may not have, and I know that you have a lot of respect for him.
Right. He was in school when the JFK assassination occurred in Dallas, Texas, on November 22nd, 1963, and I believe he graduated shortly thereafter and went into the newspaper business as a newspaper reporter up in the Fort Worth. He worked for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, okay? And I think he did police report. He was a police reporter of all things. But so he got involved in researching and investigative reporting at an early age, right out of college. So he saw the and was aware of the JFK assassination. So much of his life, or some of his life, concentrated on, I think, Crossfire was an absolutely wonderful book about the JFK assassination, which opened up many people's minds to the possibility of a conspiracy and a larger conspiratorial assassination. So, and we interviewed him. We go ahead, Charlotte.
And he had a way of explaining things that were, you know, simple and to the point. And he was he was a very clever person.
Yeah, he was, if you'll say anything about him, he was a very kind person. He could deliver his message without insulting people. What do you think?
Okay. Yes, that makes him kind and clever. I felt flattered when I had the opportunity to interview him, and he made me feel like I could learn about JFK and all the things that he knew. I mean, he just was so welcoming, and he had an open way about him.
Right. We interviewed him here in Austin at times. One thing about Jim Mars was he would go out of his way to come and help promote his books, and he was very, very cooperative with talk show hosts. And one of the things, too, it didn't matter how big you were or how small a talk show host you were, he would give you time and even drive from out of Fort Worth. He lived close to Fort Worth area most of his life. But he would drive down from Fort Worth, which is a couple of hundred miles from here, from Austin, and he would do talk shows with small talk show, you know what I mean, host. And so he was very considerate, wouldn't you think, Charlotte?
He was an inspiration to the 9/11 truth movement. He was an inspiration to UFO buffs and people seeking a brighter unknown. I mean, we're focusing in on JFK, but, oh, he was just a wide topic. I mean, he wrote extensively, and he was appreciated for it.
Yeah, I think he, we're going to be playing here a clip just to give our listening audience a little flavor of his personality. I interviewed him last November up in Dallas at the JFK assassination that Judith Berry Baker was producing up there. And I had about 12 interviews, and anyway, Jim Mars and I sat down. And I want to play that interview right now. And it's about 11 minutes long. And then we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about the interview and a little about what he had to say. So here we go right now with the Jim Mars interview last November in Dallas, Texas. He and I sat down and talked for 11 minutes. Here you go right now. Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with Jim Mars here on my right. And gosh, Jim, this is an exciting JFK conference, but of all people that I've interviewed, and I've studied this from the very start, on the very day that it occurred, I was in the Army at the time, 19 years old, but you are the one person of
of anyone that I could remember, even recall, that knows more about this than anyone else. But welcome to the program. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, George. I guess that's because at the time I was actually pretty close to it. I was in the university in a course for a degree in journalism. And of course this happened in right in my backyard. And besides that, I have a picture of me dancing on the stage of Jack Ruby's Carousel Club that was taken about a month before the assassination. So I had met Jack Ruby. I knew who ran Dallas, and yet I wasn't part of that. So I think that kind of gave me an objective viewpoint on what was going on. And I've been following this case, I mean, ever since it happened.
Well, one of the interesting parts of your career was, did you not do police reporting initially after college?
Yes.
For the Fort Worth...
Star-Telegram.
Yeah, And that gave you a basis for police work or criminal reporting, did it not? And that was very important.
That's exactly right. And in connection with my work in Fort Worth, very often I would come to Dallas to cover stories. In fact, as I would come to Dallas and I'd cover whatever story I was assigned, and then I might be sitting in front of a police official or a county official or a city official, and I'd say, hey, what can you tell me about the Kennedy assassination? And even as a young shave-tailed reporter, it was very clear that there was an aura of fear. There was a lot of fear. You know, big, tough cops that almost crawl under their desks. They didn't want to talk about it, you know. So it was obvious to me that something was going on other than a accidental shooting by a lone nut.
Well, what I didn't like was on the 50th anniversary of the event, they closed that down to most people that knew the most about it.
That's right.
I saw you up on the railroad tracks, I think, with a group.
Tasha Plumlee,
and you were up there.
That's right.
And I was up there looking at shots for a video, you know, and I did a deal with John B. Wells up there that year, I believe. But your book, one of your books, Crossfire, I don't think it shows up in the library there at the Texas School
Book Depository. No, of course not.
They don't want that there.
No, they don't want anybody to trouble them with the facts.
Right. I understand. Now, Gary Fannin told me that there's a research portion of that Texas School Book Depository museum, that does have some of your material in there, I believe. But it's by, you got to go in there and make an appointment only and things like this. Then they'll bring your book out.
So is
that because it's such an ancient, classical, really held book or what?
I tell you what, you know, they would probably argue that it was just a bunch of conspiracy theory or speculation or whatever, but it is not the truth. You've probably seen
it. A new term for that would be conspiracy scholar.
Yes.
You are truly a conspiracy scholar at the top of the group, I would think.
That's right. And I always try to tell people that if it's not an act of God, I mean, you know, planes crash, cars wreck, ships sink, and you know, but if it's not an act of God, somebody planned it that way and it was a conspiracy.
Right. I know. Did not the conspiracy idea or label come out of the JFK? Was that created specifically to cast dispersions? I mean, to order negative?
Exactly. In fact, that stemmed from a 1969 memo from the CIA to its assets. And that means not just agents or employees, but anybody who had contact, anybody who was would help them out. And it said, we're worried about people who are criticizing the Warren Commission's theory of one lone assassin, and said, this cast doubt on the U.S. government, and we need to put a stop to that. So call anybody who brings up contradictory facts, call them a conspiracy theorist, and that was passed into the mass media, and that was been pretty
it's been built on ever since then. Conspiracy nutcases and they're way off.
Anybody says they don't
care about America because they're conspiracy kid, you know.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, anything that goes contrary to the official party line, then it's a conspiracy theory, no matter how much evidence you have piled
up. You can have absolute evidence. You can have video and audio of it happening.
Right.
Totally.
And it still goes on. You know, you could have a picture, you could have a photograph of Donald Trump handing money to a terrorist or something, and they say, well, it was photoshopped. It's just a conspiracy theory.
Well, what are your comments on this last election? Where do you think the country's headed, and what would be your comments on this the election outcome and so forth?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is I don't think we had an election. I think we had a referendum. And the referendum was on the New World Order. Do we really want to go down this socialist path to a New World Order? And obviously, the mass of people said no. And so this referendum was kind of a kick in the teeth of the New World Order. But then on the other hand, we start looking at Trump personally and his connections and the possibility of coercion and blackmail, the fact that he's already doing some things. He's backing off of some of the things he promised during the campaign. So we'll just have to wait and see. It could be a really good thing, and I'm hoping that this election of Trump is a really good thing for the country, that we'll get off of that leftist socialist road and do something a little bit different. But then on the other hand, he's already making here early, before 2017, before he takes office, he's already backing off of some of the things he said, and so we may end up with just another New World Order
minion.
He seems
to have a lot of Goldman Sachs people in background around him.
Exactly.
And Josh Kushner worked for Goldman Sachs, too, and that's his son-in-law's brother, who's connected to Peter Thiel and hundreds of millions of dollars through the Thrive groups.
Exactly.
I mean, it just goes on and on. It's hard to...
Well, and if you know anything about what they collectively call the New World Order, they don't take any chances. You know, they back both horses in a race.
Right,
you know?
Exactly. Well,
so we don't know. We'll just have to wait and see.
It seemed like there was a indication that she was thrown under, you know, the bus there because of COVID.
Well, she had so
definitely he came out of the nowhere with that,
right? But then also because she had so much dirt.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there is, including dead bodies in the wake of the Clintons, political career.
The Arcaside.
Yeah, exactly. And they may have decided that she's just there's too much dirt.
My mind was she began to tarnish and destroy the Democratic brand, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And she became a focus of exposure of too many different dark secrets of the network of the real criminal conspiracy that does control things. Well, and that's could be why they got rid of her.
Exactly. You know. But that's also a good faction of what has passed for an election is the fact that even the dullest citizen now realizes that the media is biased.
Yes.
It's under control. It's the corporate media, mass media. And also that these pollsters, they're not objective. It's whoever hires them. They're going to turn the thing. And I know this. I took a course in polling one time. And just by asking certain questions, you can get the answer that you want.
You can structure the poll like you want to.
Exactly.
With the questions you ask.
Exactly.
Ask who you want to ask, right?
Right. And if it's a telephone...
I'm going to ask all Democrats. I'm going to get...
If it's, it is prohibited for pollsters to call cell phones. And most people today are using cell phones. Especially younger people.
Well, the millennials then would be excluded from
that
polling.
Yeah, so they're out.
But I think some of those are waking up. Some of those, I hope.
I agree. I think they are. So that's what I'm saying. One good thing is that people are beginning to realize how manipulated the public is. And hopefully they'll back away from that.
Well, yeah, and I've come up with some ideas that we've had seeming over the last, say, six decades that I've noticed and been an observer from 12 years old till now, is that we've had a debasement of the society. And what that results in is a lot of emotionally distraught people.
Right.
And the reaction to that is the crying and the you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but it's on both sides. It's all the way from the left to the right. I mean, the society has been changed. The transformation of the American society has occurred.
I love the line that says on this past election that the Democrats have never been so upset and mad except when the Republicans took away their slaves.
Yeah,
it's so true, isn't it?
Well, I was down at a David K. Johnston hate fest a few weeks ago at the Texas Book Festival, and they called him a con, Trump, and all this before the election, and they just roared with laughter, and they just really love that the hate to hate and resent the Trump, you know.
Well,
he wins.
I was on a program that covers most of Europe, and the host was saying, well, Hillary's a shoo-in. Hillary's going to win, you know. And I said, not so fast. I said, I don't think you're taking into account the vast amount of just average Americans out here. And I said, I think there's a real good chance that Trump will get it. And if he does, you watch. There'll be riots in the street. And I was right.
Did you make a trip to Prague just recently?
No, I was invited to Prague, but I didn't get over there. But I do understand that they are sending me the Prague Peace Prize.
They awarded you that, didn't they? And I believe Ole Domegaard, and then Fritz Springmeier.
Right.
He also awarded that too.
Yes.
But congratulations on that. Yeah, Mars, you deserve about 15 of those.
Thank you.
Not just one for your dedication, and we certainly appreciate all your hard work and everything.
Well, thank you so much, George.
Over the years. But thank you for being with us, and we certainly appreciate the time and dedication.
Okay, Charlotte, what did you think about that interview? What were your thoughts about that? Was it okay interview or what? Now that interview is over with. We just finished playing that clip for our listening audience. What do you think, Charlotte, about that interview? What were your sort of impressions and comments would be?
I thought, I wish I was there. It seems like you two had a fantastic time, and you were, you covered a lot of topics that were of interest to people and of interest to me, and I thought it was a fantastic interview.
Right.
Memorable.
Well, you know, we got into his book, Crossfire, you know, and and I went up there one year in the lobby of the Texas School Book Depository, and we did a four-hour program. You remember that?
I sure do.
And we didn't have Jim Mars on interviewing then, but we had John Judge, who was actually the organizer of four assassination symposiums every year, and one of them was JFK there in Dallas. But what do you think about that Texas School Book Depository with not his book being there? What do you think? They slighted him on that, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. So you have to get special order to get which book specifically would you recommend?
Crossfire is what they wouldn't stock there in the store. They have a store. At the Texas School Book Depository, they have a museum, and it's commemorative of the JFK. You know, it's around that JFK assassination and in his memory, too. Well, on the sixth floor, they have this sniper's nest up there with plexiglass protecting the area. And so the whole thing is set up to reiterate the government story about JFK assassination.
Well, you should call it the alleged sniper's nest.
Yeah, right. But I mean, so as a result, we went
never saw the light of day.
Charlotte was coming down from Missouri one time back to Austin, and I suggested to her, why don't you stop into the Texas School Book Depository and see if you can get us in there for 4 hours on around the next anniversary of the JFK. And so she did that. But when we got in there and started talking, they said, uh-oh, these people are too much in a conspiracy of the JFK.
Oh, so. They did not. They were very civil and polite.
No, but I mean, their thinking was that, Charlotte. They didn't want us there after we started talking. Because if you run a museum called the Texas School Book Depository, and that's the name of it at the time of the JFK, and then you have this little sniper's nest up there, and all you do is tell the story that the government came up with, then you're not doing the public any good, you know. You're just covering up the whole deal. Well, on the 50th,
unless you want to show a real psychological operation that got pulled off, that it's a good example of a psychological operation, George.
Yeah, we're on the 50th.
Put a museum up like that.
What's that?
Put a museum up like that. You know.
Well, it's not a museum. It's a lie. The whole damn thing's a lie, because it's a promotion of the government lying story. See. And so all they're doing is they're well-to-do people up there just reiterating the government line or the lies, see. And look at all the people that go through there. They just pick up on that, and they don't pick up on. Now, outside, though, they have some.
Well, how can we ask for Jim's book, though, you know?
What's that?
I mean, if people do visit, yeah, I would recommend they ask for the book Crossfire.
Right. Go in there and ask for that. But then it's tightly controlled. So what are they doing, see? It's like going to a university library and then they're burying some book way back in the back where you have to call for it and they have to go get it and then they know who you are when you're reading it, you know, instead of an open, library, open stacks library, see. So, I mean, the whole thing is just sort of controlled too much. And then on the 50th anniversary of that, we went up there. And I organized a sit-down, a symposium with Judith Ferry Baker and a lot of other people. John B. Wells was there. Jim Mars was on a panel discussion. About eight people on the panel discussion. And so we thrashed through. We talked about the JFK thing. This was a day or two before the actual anniversary date, but it was 2013. So Mars always replied and always was good about showing up. He was on time always, very courteous. Boy, he's a hell of a good guy, wasn't he, Charlotte?
Yeah, he's going to be sorely missed.
Remember, we were sitting down and doing a program one night, and Jim Mars got into some of the UFO alien type of thought also. He wrote one book. He got into the occult. Our Occult History was one book one time. But he also got into some of the UFO alien questions. But so he was speaking at Brave New Books one night. We were down in the back room broadcasting our normal live program on GCN at that time. We had on the air, on the hookup, we had Dr. Fred Bell, and we had Steve Allen. You remember Steve Allen?
I think we had a beer in the hand, too, didn't we?
Huh?
Well, yes, I do remember Steve Allen. And, yeah, I do remember that night. I can't remember, but it was a fantastic interview.
Right. Anyway, Jim Mars was speaking to a group about one of his latest books there. And so he took off for about 10 minutes and came in and sat down with us. So we had Jim Mars there who had a lot of experience, but we had Dr. Fred Bell coming in from California who had a lot more experience about the UFO alien quest than anyone. And then Steve Allen was on there who actually had observed that gigantic spacecraft that flew from Glen Rose over to Stephenville, remember?
I sure do. Stephenville, Texas, folks. Dairyland.
Right. You sat down with him at Glen Rose, at his office and did a 30-minute interview. Now, what did we do with that? You remember, Charlotte?
Yeah, it's the strangest interview I ever conducted. I got the most strangest information. He seemed as miraculously bewildered by it as I was. But I wrote it. I took it to heart, and I took a good interview.
Right. I think that was one of your finest interviews, Charlotte. Well, it was about 30 minutes long. I came back to the office. I edited it, put real good sound. We had a really good recording on that and uploaded it to Google at the time. YouTube wasn't there, okay? And started trying to listen to it, and something happened to the audio. They squashed it down, okay? So I uploaded it and got the audio, you know, proper. Uploaded it two more times, and they squashed the audio both times. You remember the car that was sitting in the parking lot when we drove in to interview Alan?
Was the government tag?
It was Department of Defense tag on it.
Yeah, that was a little bizarre.
We went in there, and also what was interesting, we're getting off of Jim Mars a little bit, but Jim Mars was there at the night of this interview, so we need to tie him into that too. But there were other things that Steve Allen showed us, some squiggly recordings. You remember those?
I sure do, like
it would like you would take a loop, a vertical loop, you know, and then you would expand and contract it and expand it very rapidly, and then turn it horizontally and do the same thing. See?
But that's not what he described in the interview.
Yeah. Well,
be clear about that.
Well, yeah.
That's not what he described in the 30-minute interview.
No, this was an additional recording that he showed us after your interview. What he, we'll put that up on tonight's program so people can view that interview. Okay, Charlotte?
Tufkin.
So yeah, they'll be able to see the whole interview. He described a gigantic spacecraft coming through there at a high rate of speed. The spacecraft was a mile long, a quarter of a mile wide or so. And what did it do? How did it blink out? Was there some kind of a flame involved in the back?
Well, like a welder's flame that took a geometric pattern shape for, I believe he said, a square.
Yeah.
The lights just seemed to configure into a square, and then he thought he saw when the square was filled with what he would call like a welder flame.
Yeah, like a dirty flame, he described it, I think, or something.
Yeah, and then, boop, gone.
What's that?
I do believe if we were to revisit, I think he said after that point they went back in the house. One guy left and the other one went back in the house. But let's get back to Jim Mars. He was such a fantastic person.
So anyway,
I'm so glad to hear.
Yeah. So anyway, we had Jim Mars there. He also wrote on population control. He wrote on our occulted history. I mean, his books were endlessly interesting. Crossfire was a big one about the JFK, PSI spies, above top secret. It goes on and on. He was very prolific. He had his nose to the grindstone a lot of times when I'd call him on his cell phone and talk to him. He was always busy, you know, on that writing. He kept his nose to the grindstone about writing, you know. And so what his widow is announced on Facebook recently is in about a month, they're going to have a gigantic Texas wake. I think they explained it that way. And at his home, you know, I think he lives on the outskirts of Fort Worth there, on some acreage or something.
A wake of many days? That would be fantastic.
A wake, Charlotte.
A wake takes days, George. They take days.
This isn't going to be days. It's going to be a one-day thing. See what I mean? And anyway,
then that's a visitation.
Well, she's talking about having a wake for him, you know. And
the wakes last more than a day, so I'm just saying. That's what a wake is.
This isn't going to be that. It's going to be a get-together for him, and she are calling it a wake, okay? But anyway, my understanding, it's going to be on a certain day. People will meet at the home there and honor him. And I would like to have something bigger than that, maybe at some kind of venue up there where people could get up and speak. We could record it. I think it would be a good historical thing to do for him.
Yes, because his information lives on.
It does. It really does. And
Alien
Agenda, Charlotte, with one of his books. I think that was the one he was speaking at the night at the Brave New Books, okay?
Yeah, I got that particular book. I enjoyed it immensely.
Right. So and then he got into money problems. He wrote about money. He wrote about population control. He wrote about the occult. He wrote about the alien question. He also
wrote about the New World Order.
Oh gosh, he knew what was happening about the world and about this country, and he knew the problems, and he feared, you know what I mean. He came down.
He knew a lot of history.
Yeah, one time we had this gal that wrote this book on Agenda 21. I forget her name, Green something, and she came into Bastrop one year. At the Opera House down there. And anyway, Jim Mars came in from Dallas, from Fort Worth, and got up and spoke for a while. And then, of course, she was the main speaker on the Agenda 21. But afterwards, we went out. I think he likes to drink a beer, too, Charlie. Okay? And so we went out to a place downtown, Bastrop, sat down. He was with his wife that night. She came down with him. She's a very, very nice lady. And anyway, we sat there in this Bastrop restaurant, which they had, you know, beer available too. And we had a nice conversation. One of the first times I really sat down with him on an informal level, you know what I mean? But other than that, we always spoke and met and talked at the JFK, assassination. And they're going to have another one this coming November also up in Dallas, but I think it's going to be maybe on the 20th of November. You can go into Facebook, Judith Berry Baker, on Facebook, and I think you can find the details there. But anyway, what were your friends, Charlotte? Did they read much of Jim Mars, or what were some of the opinions of some of the people that you knew?
He was well respected by the people that I was running around with during that time frame, and as far as I know, he's highly respected. He had a way of communicating that was very persuasive and full of good reason and logic, and he didn't waste your time, and people appreciated that about him, and he was well respected for what he did.
Right.
By the people I knew. I don't know anybody that didn't have respect for Jim Mars. Nobody discounted him.
No, he had a way he was a short guy. He wasn't real tall, but he wasn't, you know, very, very small either. He was sort of a medium height guy, a little on the short side. He always had a beard in his later years, but he was an affable, friendly, accommodating, open, very polite. He had manners that were the greatest. When you talked to him, he was standing there and talking to you, okay? I was trying to not interrupt him, but I'd be standing there waiting to get him, you know, up there in Dallas to get him set up for the next. And when he was talking to someone, they had, you know, they had his full attention, okay? And so he really was respectful of people that he was speaking to at the time. And so forth. And you just had to wait.
Can I say it?
What's that?
I know. Can I just say it, George?
What?
Can I just say it?
What?
I've had a beer with Jim Mars, and I really enjoyed it. While talking to Fred Bell.
Right.
Followed up by Colin.
Right.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the beer I had with Jim Mars. And that particular interview was fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. And then Jim went back and did his finishing work there. I met him at times. Okay, go ahead.
Brave New Books that big of a venue. Yeah.
What's that?
Brave New Books only sat about, what, 30 to 50 people?
Where's that?
Or so how many people would we cram in there?
Oh, there were 100 sometimes in there.
Yeah, the overflow up in the...
Oh, well, at some of the events down there, when Jim Mars came into town, it would spill over into the back. I remember one year we had a monitor in the back room back there, see? Because the people were just, you know, overwhelmingly, you know, wanting to hear him speak. But the main room there was fairly narrow, but you could get easily 10 or 15 rows of seats with 8 or 10 in each row on each side. Pretty easily. So you get 80 to 100 people in there in that room, the main room, pretty easily.
Full double room.
Yeah, and sometimes it would overflow into the back part where the books were. And then, if need be, people could always go to the back room where we broadcast from at times and go from there with the view of it from a LED or something back there. Mars probably had what?
Sad.
Huh?
It's real sad that he's gone, George. It's just real sad.
Yeah, Jim Mars had one of the greatest minds, I would say, on the they're labeling him conspiracy and all this, but Eric Samuelson was one of our friends, Charlotte and our friend, and he pioneered in the Alton area in the Patriot movement. And he provided information to Jim Mars about the Federal Reserve. That went way back. I don't know if you knew that, Charlotte.
I didn't know that part, George. No.
Yeah, Jim Mars wrote a book, and there was a reference, I think, in the book. It was in the 90s. I forget what book it was. So he got in touch with Eric Samuelson, and Eric Samuelson gave him a reference of the ownership of the Federal Reserve System, see? Okay? And a $1 trillion, you know, book was another here lately in the last few years of Jim Mars. He was a New York Times best-selling author, so he sold a great number of books, see. And Oliver Stone, I think, consulted with him when he did the JFK movie in Dallas. Remember?
Oh, yeah. And I don't remember doing that. No,
I mean, you remember the JFK movie, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly, yeah.
Well, that movie was pretty good, factually, pretty close to what I think actually happened up there. And so it wasn't too far removed from some of the actual realities of what happened there in Dealey Plaza, see. I've been around Dealey Plaza during the JFK things, and Jim Maher to be up there on the railroad tracks, okay? And one year, he had a group, and he was open to where if he was by himself or with some other people, you could walk up to him and start talking. He'd take you and give you an excursion almost of the Dealey Plaza. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that particular day, it was a couple, 2 or 3 years ago, we went up there and I interviewed John B. Wells up above the Elm Street and all that, where you could look down and see where the limousine was coming towards you. There were two streets there. On the left street was Elm Street. It came downhill, see. And you could actually have a perspective of a possible location of where a sniper, could be located, see. And I've seen Jim Marge up there with groups before, lecturing to them and discussing the viewpoints from that train overpass. It was a train trestle that went over the streets that went underneath, see. And so some of the theories that he had and so forth and evidence that he had developed would say that there were some shots that did come from in that area where the train trestle was, see, the overpass of the train. And then there were other evidence that the Texas Dow building from directly behind the limousine path, some came from there, and some came from maybe the behind the picket fence, and there were other places, locations around the Dealey Plaza that possible shots came from. But I took some relatives to the JFK movie when it first came out here in Austin. And there were some visitors, some in-laws from Washington State. And so we went out bowling, and then later after bowling, I took them over and treated them to the JFK movie. And they were astounded by that movie, you know. And so now Sean Stone has been one of our guests within the last year also, and that's, Oliver Stone's son, Sean Stone.
He authored a book.
Right, he authored a book on the New World Order. And it's pretty respectful book. And we were down in
Louisville.
What's that?
It's time to stand our ground, you know, on this whole New World Order, 9/11 truth stuff.
Yeah.
As we go forward, you know, it's just, I don't know, Jim Maher's always provided a lot of hope, you know.
Well,
he always made me feel hopeful.
I'm sure he was threatened over the years with as much insight that he gave and did. I'm sure over the years he was threatened because his insight was so good, see, about what was really going on. It was hard to attack the man because he was factual so much, see. He didn't just go out there and do assertions without backing it up with facts and some evidence, okay? He always could back himself up. And I remember the night on the 50th anniversary of JFK in that church in Dallas. He shone like a brilliant light about the JFK, and everybody looked to him, see, because they knew he was the authority on that 8-member panel of discussions there. And we had people like John B. Wells that was there, and he spoke. Oh, he loved Jim Maher. John B. Wells always spoke highly of Jim Maher. There wasn't anyone I ever met that spoke poorly of him, was he? Was there?
So, I agree, yeah.
So on that panel discussion we had, that worked out pretty good. Now, Alex was down there on the ground behind the courthouse, and they gave him hell that day of the anniversary. And I believe the mayor at that time had a controlled memorial invitation-only crowd out there in 2013. So that didn't go down well with the Patriot group at all. And so it just, you know, it just didn't work too good, you know. But
well, I'm hopeful that people will reach me and find their Jim Mars interviews and bring his books and everything to the forefront as we celebrate his wonderful life and unfortunate, you know, passing.
It's Jim. It's jimmars.com, JimMars.com, and that's his website. And on that website, he has his books, and he has a nice site. It's really in depth. He really has a I'm trying to count here. Let's see. 3, 6, 7, 8, 9. There's 9 on this site so far, book-wise. Let me go to the second page here and see what else he has. He has well over 9 books. There must be about 14 or 15 books in all. Let's see, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. 13 on his website. Okay. 1, Rule by Secrecy, The Hidden History. See what I mean? I mean,
right.
And he knew the Nazi problem too, Charlotte. You know that?
I have a Nazi problem. I was discussing it with my daughter today.
Yeah.
Even my millennial thinks that we have a sense. She has a sense of the impending state fascism that, the New World Order is going to bring in globally with a two-step military, one world army, and all these other things, and even microchipping us.
Right.
So there's people that. It's not that far-fetched, and even my millennial has a sense of you know, I just lost my train of thought. I'm sorry, George.
Right. Right. No, that's good. He got into so many different important issues during his lifetime. And
oh, the Nazi question, yeah. I'm sorry, George. I apologize.
Well,
she'd rather be on the winning side. I'd rather be a part of the fascism. I'd rather be part of the mechanism than on the outside of it. And I said, well, then that makes us Nazis. That'll make you a Nazi.
What's that?
If you're on the inside of the system that is going to be the police state, the New World Order,
Yeah. Now,
if you're going to, everybody's going to end up working for it or owing something to it in one capacity or another because of consolidation of power into. You know, instead of separation of powers, you got one world full. And that dream, those psychopathic people, they're going to keep doing it.
Right. Well, he had one called the Sisterhood of the Rose. And it was about the Nazis' fascination with the occult, see. Okay? The Thule Society was one of their first societies that the Nazi Party was associated with early on in Munich, see. And,
We have Yale, where all our early American families send their best and brightest to go through a sexual, type of thing in a coffin. What would you call it? Hazing? College hazing?
It's initiation. It's initiation.
Initiation.
Yeah, there's 15.
The initiation.
Yeah,
and
there's
parallels. You know, it's creepy.
It is creepy. Oh, one of the things that I uncovered in researching and so we could do this program and memorial program for Jim Mars is that I was looking back at some of the other, JFK material, see? And one of the most important interviews that we did over the years was with Donald Gibson, okay? And Donald Gibson was a professor out of New York universities, okay, that group up there. And he wrote some very insightful books about JFK's geopolitical stance at the time before he was assassinated. And it's really eerie in the sense that the same parties, the same players that took out JFK look like that they have formed an alliance against Trump. In this situation, it's about the same group, Charlotte.
Then let's go.
Huh?
I know. I mean, it's confusing to get the American news take on this and to hear what you just said.
Yeah.
It's very confusing to follow what's going on. But if Trump is going to be our guy in white, you know, with the white hat. He is going to, you know, put America first.
Well, you know, Donald Gibson wrote about JFK, and he wanted to strike a detente with the Soviet Union at the time. And these warmongers that were against him didn't want that, and they wanted to push the Vietnam War too, see, to make money for munitions and stuff.
You mean the Vietnam action.
That's
right. The Vietnam War.
And so there were General Dynamics in there controlled by people out of Chicago at the time, and there were big, big interests, you know, that could make money off the Vietnam War. And JFK wanted to come out of that. He wanted to strike a detente with the Soviet Union and so forth. And so these are some of the things that I uncovered because of our interviews with Donald Gibson. And then also Jim Mars, he knew a lot of these aspects. You could talk to him about any of these aspects that we're bringing up now, and he knew something about them, didn't he, Charlotte?
Yeah, he sure did. And he was never arrogant or pushy, or he always was had a humorous way of bringing you forward with him.
Yeah, he was very, very moderate in his approach to speaking and so forth. A very, very, very humble type person. Spoke with humility, you know what I mean? And so,
yeah, you know, he's a legend in his own time for us, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, we're here tonight, Charlotte Littlefield Brown and myself, George Butler, to honor Jim Mars. He passed away last Wednesday. His wife is planning a wake sometime in about a month. She said, announced on Facebook just a day or so ago, and don't know when that date is yet. We're sort of thinking it would be nice to have a memorial somewhere, maybe inside a kind of a venue up there in Dallas somewhere, Fort Worth, and really invite all the people in that can get into a pretty good sized venue as a memorial for him. And then we could have speakers and people that know him to get up and give 10, 15, 20 minute speech about their own personal experience with Jim Mars, which is probably, well, a great deal more than what our experience has been. But we've seen him up front. We know him personally. We shook his hand, sat down, had a drink with him. And he was just really, really a nice person overall, you know. And he spoke with authority, didn't he, Charlotte? Huh?
Yeah, although he was gentle, he had authority. There's no question about it, the way he carried himself. But like I said, he wasn't arrogant. He was believable, affable. You know, I wonder, he was human, obviously, George. We don't know the downside to his personal life or anything like that. But, yeah, I mean, as far as I can tell, he's going to be sorely missed by the 9/11 truthers.
Well, he was happily married, I think, all of his life. And I think he has a daughter or something, and some grandchildren. There was a photograph on the web of him holding one of his little kids on his chest, you know, loving on him, you know what I mean? And now that's Jim Mars to me, you know what I mean? The gentleness,
yeah.
He's a gentle soul. Would you say that, Charlotte?
Yeah, I never felt like, but he would talk about the firefight. If you know what I mean, at the figure of speech.
Yeah.
Yes, he was a gentle soul. But he had a way of talking about the firefight that kept you, you know, calm and following and just so intriguing. He was a very intriguing storyteller.
Right. And anyway, he'll be missed by everyone, and we're just trying to bring some of our own experiences over the years that we had with him. And JFK figured into his life. That was a big thing, wasn't it, in his life, huh?
Oh, yeah. You'd know more about it better than I would, George. And I'd love to hear more about it, because I know if he has your respect, then he did some cutting-edge things. And perhaps you could tell me where he, why some of the insights that he had that you greatly, you know, appreciated.
Well, you know, he brought on his Crossfire book, okay? We know from the very beginning, from the JFK thing. I was in the Army at the time, And I came home from the Army after my schooling, my electronic schooling, and then spent Christmas, that Christmas after the assassination in Austin. Well, when I was getting ready to go back, to, and I was transferred going into Germany on my first assignment, I caught a ride on LBJ's Air Force One, okay? And so I wasn't on Air Force One. Excuse me, let me rephrase that. One of our neighbors lived across the street from us, where I grew up. He was the head of security, NCOIC, of Bergstrom, okay? And so I was talking to him. He said, come on out. I'll show you Air Force One if you come on out, you know. So I was getting ready to leave to go back to Washington, D.C. for reassignment to Germany. And so I thought, well, I'll just get a hop, you know, from Bergstrom Air Force Base back to Andrews, and then I could be right there in Washington for my reassignment orders and stuff, which I did, you know, do. But anyway, we had to wait all day, and that evening we got ready to leave. And, of course, LBJ comes out in a limousine, gets into Air Force One, which at that time was a 707, okay? And he zooms off into the air, and here we are in a little Convair plane, you know what I mean? And I'm sitting in there with the PFC stripes on. I had to wear my uniform to get onto the base and to get, you know, a hop, you know. But here I was. I was on a hop, an LBJ entourage hop on the little Convair plane. And we were flying to Washington, D.C., you know. Well, we got up into the air, and I was sitting next to assistant to the assistant press director. You know what I'm saying? And there were other soldiers on board that were the cooks in the White House. And in fact, I think LBJ had brought in some cooks from the U.S. Army to cook food for him in the White House. They probably got some of the best, you know, out of the Army. And so here we are in this plane, and I've got press secretary to assistants to the assistants to the assistants. Press secretary's on my right. I've got, you know, cowboys from Texas in the Army cooking for him in the White House. And we had a tremendous conversation. You can imagine. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And I don't remember everything that, you know, was said because it was over 50 years ago at this time, 55 years ago or so. But anyway, got to Washington, and then I got a hop down to where we departed out of South Carolina to Germany, and everything worked out okay. But anyway, that was sort of one of my little experiences on an LBJ hop, you know. Later on, we would find out, I think Roger Stone has tied LBJ into it. Of course, Roger Stone has always been at the conferences that Jim Mars was at. You had Roger Stone, Jim Mars, John B. Wells. Ole Domegaard. Remember Ole Domegaard, Charlotte?
I remember the name for sure, yeah.
Yeah, he is the biggest, you could say, freedom and liberty, you could say, broadcaster in Europe, okay? And he's written some very insightful books. In fact, he's written a book on the JFK assassination himself, okay? He's living in Spain right now, and I've talked to him. I may interview him sometime later this evening or whatever. But anyway, after the program's over with, probably get online with him to Spain. He got threatened, you know what I mean, by people up in Copenhagen and Stockholm, so he had to leave. So he moved to Spain for his safety and his family and everything. But anyway, he's traveling. What's that?
Did Jim ever reveal to you any time that he might have been threatened that you felt like? Because I felt like he must have had the thumbprint on him, you know?
Well, I don't think I ever asked him that question, and I'm trying to, with the hundreds of hours of interviews that I've listened to with him on other programs and then on our programs that we had him two or three times, it never came up, you know what I'm saying? I wouldn't dismiss that possibility at all, but you know, I'm sure he was threatened by someone.
I know he used to joke about black helicopters.
Yeah.
I remember a joke. I remember joking, you know, the idea of with him, you know. He just had a good sense of humor. He was a nice guy. The world's going to sorely miss him. I miss him. We're losing a lot of great people, George.
Yeah. The Secret Team by L. Fletcher Prouty was a book. L. Fletcher Prouty was one of the characters in the JFK movie. Okay? He was depicted as in the movie. There was an agent that they met out in the park. Okay? And that agent was L. Fletcher Prouty. Okay? L. Fletcher Prouty was a great guy out of the Pentagon. He finally retired as an officer. I think he was a colonel. But he provided liaisons for the CIA. Okay? And during the JFK, before the JFK and after, he was in Antarctic. So L. Fletcher Prouty was sent by the Pentagon to the Antarctic to babysit some VIPs and show them around the Antarctic. I mean, like South Pole. You know what I mean? So we feel that he was, transferred down or went on that assignment to get him out of the way because he could have blown the whistle on anything that was in the works on killing JFK, see? Now, when he was...
Yeah, who has that kind of control, George, that can get people in different continents?
Well, this is the deep state. They're against Trump now, see?
The people that, you know, a lot of things have gone down in our history where everybody turns out to be, oh, guess what, a CFR member.
Yeah.
Or guess what, everybody turns out to be trilateral commissioner.
Right.
Or guess what, and this lends itself to conspiracy. And to think, you know, that person could be taken out of a whole theater of operation and put in a location on another continent. I mean, come on, that's global thinking.
Well,
this is a global. Yeah. This lends itself to global conspiracy.
Right. When he was coming back, L. Fletcher Prouty was coming back from Antarctic. There was a stopover, I think, in Australia or something. Okay. And he looked at some newspapers there. Okay. That were announcing that Lee Harvey Oswald did it, but it was too early for that to be known. Okay. By the Australians.
I'm in agreement. Yeah, it's called a psychological operation,
they already had Lee Harvey as the target, as a scapegoat on the JFK, and then they would just close down. And then they invented that magic bullet theory, and of course, Jim knew all about that. Jim Mars did, and I mean, he laughed when he brought that up, or someone would ask a question to Jim Mars. Hey, Jim, what about this magic bullet theory? See, he laughed. One year down here in Austin, the guy that was a counsel to the Warren Commission, an attorney, forget his name, he came in to speak, and of course he was in favor of and supportive of the government line on the JFK thing, okay? So he talked about how the magic bullet theory was discovered by one of these future senators that was one of the counsels also, you know what I mean? And the guy jumped up and said, oh, I think it was this bullet did this, you know, and everybody, that's it, you know. Well, anyway, he explained about the magic bullet theory, okay, a little bit. And then the first questioner from the audience to that man was, Mr. So-and-so, could you elaborate a little bit more on the magic bullet theory? And everybody laughed in the room, in the tent, because it was the C-SPAN tent. Okay? Arlen Specter is the future senator that would invent the magic bullet theory. You know, what a despicable idea that was. But the American public, they just absorb this stuff and they're just out of it, Charlotte. You know, they're not even close.
Well, individually, people know. It's just difficult to get us together. You know, I just don't know. I just think we all have to forgive each other, honor each other, do the best we can, respect each other, and hopefully we'll come through this.
I just don't
have any of the answers, but I just hate to lose Jim Mars, George. That's a sad day.
Yeah, it is. Well, we're about the end of our program. We've got to say goodbye to our listening audience. But, Charlotte, thanks for being with us this evening on this and giving your insights and being a good friend and a talk show host along with myself. And we really want to
thank
Jim Mars. He's passed away. We want to thank his family. But anyway, thank you, Charlotte, and appreciate your time and on this memorial program.
Well, thank you, George, and I love you. Okay. You have a good one.
Love you, babe. Bye-bye.
Bye.